A reading from Sri Bhakti Narada Bhakti Sutra 7. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sana Kamayamana Narodha Rupatvat. There's no question of lust. The execution of pure devotional service, because in all material activities, in it, all material activities are announced. Please mute your phone. Okay, one sec. Okay. There is no question of lust in the execution of pure devotional service, because in it all material activities are renounced. Purport. Pure devotional service, there is no question of sense gratification. Some people mistake the loving affairs between Krishna and the gopis for activities of ordinary sense gratification. But these affairs are not lustful because there is no material contamination. As Rupa Goswami states in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1.2.285, Premaiva Goparamanan Kama Ityagnamatpatam Ityudavo Deopyaitam Panchati Bhagavat Priya. Although the dealings of the gopis with Krishna are wrongly celebrated by many as lust, great sages and saintly persons like Uddhava hank of such loving affairs. Okay. Narada Bhakti Sutras. I think what I will do is, again, just start from the beginning to give an overview. Explains what is bhakti in the first six verses. So verse 1, now, therefore, we shall explain the nature of devotion as bhakti. The subject of the book is declared. By saying now, declarative term, the urgency of bhakti is promoted. The urgency for self-realization is promoted, and the process of bhakti. Text 2 says the subject has been declared. Now, a definition of bhakti. And the nature of bhakti is the topmost form of love, prema bhakti, or parma prema. So what's the nature of bhakti? Nature of bhakti is pure love, prema means, and for God. Narada Bhakti Sutras is a theistic text. When you talk about bhakti, you have to talk about God. If everything is one, completely undifferentiated, then there's no object of love, there's no subject of love, and there's no love. Bhakti means there must be a subject of love, there must be an object of love, and there must be the love itself. So, third verse says, and this love, this pure bhakti, this prema is eternal. So, I guess Narada and the Narada Bhakti Sutras, because it states, okay, that the highest thing is topmost form of love for God, then the natural misunderstanding is that this is just a means to an end, like every other process. And therefore, neither God nor the lover of God, the devotee, or the love really exists. They're saying, no, this is eternal. Then the fourth verse explains, having attained this bhakti, one becomes perfect, immortal, and peaceful. So, saying again, it's eternal, and it is the perfection. It's perfection. It's not something, there's something beyond that. But to love God and to serve God is not just some temporary practice to get to something else. It is the perfectional state. And it is your natural state. It's the perfectional state, and therefore it's eternal. It's the summum bonum. It's the goal. If you look at bhakti as just a process to get someplace else, then it's neither eternal, it's neither immortal, and it's neither satisfying, because otherwise you would stop. So here, bhakti is the highest position. It's this amrita sarup, this nature of bhakti is perfect. And having that perfectional state, which is a heart full of love, then there's no more feverish yearning. So, person having bhakti, you don't desire anything, you don't lament, you don't hate, you don't enjoy anything in your person, you don't become very enthusiastic in material activity, you want nothing, lament nothing, hate nothing, delight never for anything material, because you have satisfaction, you have perfection. So it stops. And this kind of renunciation is not just vairagya, where you look at the world and say, no, 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 no. It's a partner to the full satisfaction that's mentioned in the previous verse. You become shanti, you become peaceful, you're satisfied. And when you're satisfied, then you don't search for other things. Most of our habits and things that we do are a result of not finding, of seeking satisfaction. And you have to ask yourself honestly, have you found it in the things that you're doing? And when you do find it in the things that you're doing, then you'll stop. So the buck stops here. It stops here at bhakti. It's the perfected state. And then verse 6, and not only the perfected state, but it's the ecstatic state. It's overwhelming emotion, because the perfected state is love. It's love to the highest degree, and it's an intoxicating conception of reality. Just like we have the example of Lord Chaitanya, we have his example that his guru asked him when he met the impersonalist, asked him, why are you chanting and dancing like a madman? And then he explained, this is what his guru said, and this is actually the perfectional stage of life. So, now, today's verse, so this is described this bhakti is like a very emotional state. An emotional state is generally connected with desire. So there's a question, is this actually spiritual? So here the verse answers that bhakti is not caused by worldly desire because in bhakti all desires have ceased. So if all desires have ceased, then this emotional state of bhakti is something spiritual, is something eternal, is something of the soul. It's not a product of ego and selfishness. I'm crying because I didn't get what I want. I'm laughing in ecstasy because I got what I want in an egotistical way. It's all related to the highest selflessness. You're separated from God and you're crying because you can't serve God the way you want. And you're in ecstasy because you've gotten service. It's a whole different mindset and conception. It's a platform of selflessness and purity. So when bhakti awakens, all worldly desires cease. Everything that we're doing is generally trying to counteract the sense of emptiness in our heart because there's not sufficient love in the heart. That's basically the reason why people have addictions. Because there's a want of love in their heart, which is ultimately the most satisfying thing. And not just limited love, but universal love. Love for God. So when there's not love in the heart, then you seek things elsewhere, not knowing that the problem is the emptiness in the heart. You're thinking the problem is the senses are not stimulated enough, or I don't have enough fame and prestige. So here it's saying that all these emotions and these incredible sentiments, if you read the descriptions sometimes of the great bhakti saints, is described as mad or intoxicated or dancing wildly or crying. Because I'm giving this seminar on it, I'm getting such good ideas just by I'm taking notes simultaneously. This is a good book. So what I was thinking of is maybe reading Chaitanya Bhagavat. Then next verse, number 8. So it describes that one who has bhakti, he's renounced. So now it's going to define what that renunciation means in bhakti. It means you abandon all worldly and even Vedic activities that are selfish. Even Vedic activities, fruit of activities mentioned in the Vedas, so much of the Vedas, 90% of the Vedas, is called Kaitava Dharma. it's, you know, you worship and you sacrifice to fulfill a personal desire. So what renunciation means, you're giving up any endeavor, selfish endeavor. And why? Because when bhakti fills part, they become significant. You don't have that seed in your heart. But karma, kanda, sense gratification, jnana karma, personal liberation, yoga kanda, mystic powers. You have the bhakti latta bij. You've come in contact with a line that's put pure love and selflessness in your heart, and that's your desire. So, this is what this renunciation means. And there's a further description. And when there is this kind of renunciation, it means complete, exclusive dedication for God and indifference to anything else that opposes that. This is what renunciation in devotional service. Some deep inner satisfaction comes in your heart with your dharma or your position as part of God and meant for God's service. And you're so satisfied in that. You found your shelter. You found where to repose your love. And therefore this hither and thither seeking personal rewards. You become completely fixed in devotion. And indifferent. When you're satisfied, it's not that you just stay renounced, but you're indifferent. I was telling you, this Ramananda Roy, he had so much love for Godhead, and he was a great king, and he was training the Devi Dasis. They would marry Lord Jagannath, young girls, so they would dance for Jagannath, and he would bathe their naked bodies without any disturbance. So one becomes indifferent. And in the Gaudiya line, there's the example of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. They were the wealthiest, this is historical, most aristocratic people. And then, Jakva Turna Mashesha Mandalapati, Sainim Sadatuchavat, Bhutva Dinagan. They gave all aristocracy as insignificant. So now, it describes the symptoms of renunciation, text 10, are exclusiveness in bhakti means abandon of all other shelters. So what is a shelter? A shelter is sense of longing, support, desires fulfilled, satisfaction, and power to do so. So you are one-pointed in your dedication because you found what you're looking for, which is a heart filled with love. And you found the worthy object of devotion. Something that's not temporary, which is reality, and which is real, it's not illusion, and it's a relationship. Because ultimately, the shelter we want is a relationship that fills our heart with love. How disappointed have many of us, and most of us, been throughout life outside of God, trying to find that place where you can repose your love and open your heart. In a way that, it's unending. So basically what's happened in this section so far is, after describing the ecstatic states of bhakti, it's saying, well, no, this can't be material because a devotee is renounced. And what does this renunciation mean? It means exclusivity and indifference. You have found your shelter. You have found that place, that relationship that you're completely satisfied with and feel sheltered and protected in. Eternally. Otherwise, it's not going to be a session. The shelter has to be two things. It has to be real. It can't be superficial. You know, you want to take shelter of a person, but you take shelter of their body. You're not really taking shelter of the person. And you want the person to be eternal. So when you have that bhakti, that inner satisfaction, you become renounced. Why? You have found your shelter. And indifference is described. Is undertaking only activities which are in ordinary life or those enjoined in the Vedas, whatever customs, only those activities which are conducive to supporting that relationship with the divine. Only those. So that's a renounced person. He adopts those things that support. Indifferent to anything that's not supporting his relationship with God. Completely detached. Now the next verse, 12, but even though he's giving up so many Vedic and social activities and things mentioned, here it says he continues to follow the injunctions. Even if he becomes gay, he continues to follow the injunctions. Because indifferent meant to give up those that were favorable. This verse says, give up those things that are unfavorable. This verse says one must never give up what is favorable. Walking in the light of Shastra is synonymous with God. You're walking in the light of Shastra. In your spiritual path, you're guided. Shastra means to command. In the bhakti path, you're commanded by truth, by knowledge that is favorable to the cultivation of this selfless love with God. And you, otherwise, if you're not, there's risk of fall. There's risk of fall. Because if you want to be guided just by how you feel, rather than any vow or understanding, then if you're not pure, sometimes how you feel is also not pure. You may have some devotion in your heart, but you may have such attraction to so many other things. So if you, on the bhakti path, prematurely give up the injunctions of Shastra to rule your life in the appropriate way, thinking that I'll just act out of love. Well, if the heart's not completely filled with love, then you won't remain fixed. In other words, when you have impulse that is a klesha, not favorable to your advancement in spiritual life, then you have to be fixed in a principle that's beyond the mental plane. And that's the intelligence is beyond the mental plane. So the intelligence and guided. This is right because this is in Shastra. I follow what's proper for me, not just what my mind thinks. And if you loosen that and simply want to be guided by your impulse, well, not all your impulses are pure. So there's great danger. 14. So in addition to the duties that you perform, it says here you should also perform activities essential for supporting life, sleeping, eating, etc. But only to the point of sustaining the body for the purpose of Krishna consciousness. You eat. But you don't live to eat, you eat to live. You don't live to enjoy, you enjoy to live. Only what you need. Minimizing eating, sleeping, bathing, defending. This is a person who's serious about spiritual life. He's always minimizing his social, his political, his eating, his sleeping. He sees the body as a vehicle to discern soul's journey. He uses it for that purpose and not for egotistical or gluttonous purposes. So this is a very balanced conception of a devotee's renunciation. He's exclusively dedicated to God. He's found his shelter. He's indifferent to other things. But the things that he needs, he takes them just to keep body and soul together. And neglects the worldly and social duties that are connected with the ego. Now, the next section describes now the characteristics of devotional service. It says the characteristics of devotional service will be described according to various authoritative opinions. So now Narada is going to give a definition of bhakti. After now he's dealt with worldly duties, how you renounce the world, what things you keep. Now he's getting back to this parama prem. Now how is this described, this parama prem, this absolute love of Godhead? So that's what he's thinking. You know, how is it described? There's different, what are the definitions? How is it defined? And he's saying different thinkers say different things. So how to reconcile it? For example, Vyas, son of Parsimuni, says, page 16, bhakti is fond attachment for worshiping the Lord. It's the love to worship and act for God. So, this is one way. of worshiping. You can see God in that way. You can see God in works. This mentions the word puja. Your activities, you do, you're doing active service, and you're very fond of turning things towards God in the various ways. That's bhakti. Someone who has bhakti in his heart, he's very happy and fond to look at the world in relationship to the service of God. Now, another person, Gargamuni, says fondness for spiritual conversation. So this is also the symptom. There'll be a question of whether there's a comparison here or just different ways. So one is definitely the symptom of bhakti is one looks at the world. He sees things in the world, not in relationship to his own ego, but in relationship to God, into the satisfaction, and he looks at things, and he transforms them. Now, here's another way, fondness of narrations, because when you have love, the main symptom of love is the impetus to talk about your beloved. And as bhakti sanjayate bhakti, bhakti causes bhakti, and bhakti is this focus of the consciousness on the divine. Hearing about your beloved is such a powerful act and object of devotion. Bhakti is no different than your desire to hear. You want to know if you love someone or not? What is your attraction to hearing about them? Even Narada's own example was when he was young. What was his own example? He somehow heard from these great souls. Hearing, this is how devotion arises in the heart. And then another opinion in 18... that bhakti results from removing obstacles for the soul's inner affection. So the first was karma, the second one is works, gira is words, manasa, this is kind of the mind. So what is it? When the mind delights in the self and there's no more obstructions from taking pleasure in the nature of the self, which is to love God, and that's bhakti. When that soul is reflected in the consciousness, the nature of the soul is to serve. That's what's reflected in the consciousness. Narada, however, says that it is the offering of everything and feeling the highest pains of separation on account of losing remembrance of it. So Narada here kind of sums it up. What is bhakti? Offering everything, mind, body, words, with the intention to please God. And if it's real bhakti, real love, real nature of the soul devotion, it's the pain of separation on account of remembering. There's prayers by great souls with in the Vilap Kushmanjali, a very, very esoteric book, where these younger gopis, manjaris, and they have so much love for Sri Radha that everything they have is an offering. says they pray to Radha to please cure this servant of yours near dead by the with the red lac from the of the red with the red lac of the lotus of your feet. Please cure this servant of yours near dead by the snake bite of separation. So Narada says that this bhakti consists of these most intense feelings, that every action is an offering to God, everything. Intention to please God. And it's so internally deep that losing remembrance is the greatest point. And this is, and then it says, this bhakti is concluded, it's described in these ways. Now, in text 21, because the section we're at is really describing what is the essence of bhakti. It says, in the example of the gopis, it says the gopis of Vraja are the examples of bhakti as described here. Such as the, he gave the ultimate definition, now he gives an example. The gopis are completely selfless. They gave up everything which did not support their selfless service to God. Krishna blew his flute, they left. They left, representing again the universal desire is higher than the individual desire. Very spiritual, broad love. Although it's embodied within Krishna, Krishna is inclusive. He's the basis of existence, so it's loving everyone. Now, I'm really trying to figure out the next three verses. And I've been struggling with it for days. And I'll show you why. The 21 says, the coward women of Vraja are example of pure bhakti. And then it says, even in the case of the gopis, one cannot criticize them for forgetting the Lord's greatness. The next verse, it's trying to see how it makes sense. It says, on the other hand, displays of devotion without knowledge of God's greatness are no better than the affairs of illicit lovers. So here it says, even in the case of gopis, one cannot criticize them for not being mahatmya gyan. They can't be criticized for not having mahatmya gyan. But on the other hand, displays of devotion without knowing God's greatness are just, it says, no better than adultery. So how do you resolve that? In the case of the gopis, you can't criticize them for forgetting the Lord's greatness. Of course, they know something deeper than the Lord's greatness, and that's his heart. They often mention that position is very limiting to person. Very limiting. Because the higher your position, then the less of you you can show to those in relationship with you. The higher your position, the more distant you are from people. So, having understanding of God's greatness, but the gopis, they don't want to know Krishna, they just want to love Krishna. And the relationship is very intimate. So Krishna lifts the veil of his opulence when he feels relaxed and at home. But more of the person comes out. So he said, he's mentioning now the gopis have the highest and the topmost love. Now, in case someone's thinking, well, how is that? They don't even have knowledge of God. But here it says, even in the case of the gopis, they can't be criticized for that. And then the next verse says, it should say why, but I'm trying to figure out. It says, on the other hand, displays of devotion without knowledge of God's greatness are no better than the affair. And they can't be criticized because, of, you know, for that. But on the other hand, generally, this type of love without knowledge is very, very cheap. The love without respect, without understanding, it's kind of very, very cheap. You know, you usually love has some understanding. This is my husband. This is my wife. My son. This is my daughter. This is my parents. In terms of the conjugal relationship, displays of this devotion without knowledge of the person's position is considered very cheap. So maybe the next verse should resolve it. Let's see if it does. Well, it says, in such false devotion, one does not find pleasure exclusively in the Lord's pleasure. Well, that's what the definition of happiness is. Happiness is the happiness of your beloved. So it means that it's true devotion that they have because their pleasure is exclusively in God's pleasure. They may not know that he's God. In the Govardhan Lila, they didn't even know he was Krishna. Not the Govardhan Lila, when, or the Brahma Vimohan Lila, when Lord Brahma stole all the cowherd boys and calves, and then Krishna Krishna duplicated himself. The mothers and the parents, they were loving their child more. They were loving their child more because Krishna had, their children were stolen, and Krishna duplicated himself to all their children and all the calves, and Krishna duplicated himself in all the calves. And the parents and the cows were loving them more. They did not know that it was God. They did not even know it was Krishna. So there's no defect in that kind of love, because it's love. They find pleasure exclusively in the pleasure of their beloved. So it's not a defect that they don't know, are not aware of God's greatness, as it would be in an informal relationship, just for sensual pleasure, adultery. without any formality, without any understanding. But I'm also discussing an other interpretation of these verses, which goes something like this. The Vraja Gopis illustrate pure devotion best. They may be forgetful of Krishna's divinity, but that is not a fault. No, it's this way. Vraja Gopis illustrate pure devotion best. You cannot criticize that they are not aware of Krishna's divinity. Now, this is a question. If it's interpreted that way, they have some awareness of Krishna's divinity. And it's part of their inspiration for love. And Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur describes, it's like when you boil a big pot of milk in India, you don't want it to overflow, you throw some grass in it. And the grass kind of disappears and just occasionally comes up. So it's like that with Krishna's divinity. The gopis are aware. Cannot criticize they're not aware. They are aware. And 23, and if they're not aware, then their love would just be like adultery. But they are aware. It's just that awareness does not cover their midurya. Someone, a mother may be proud, her son's the president of the United States. And that's part of her love, is the wonderful qualities of her son. But it doesn't cover the fact that she sees her son in need and inferior, that she does not see the mahatmya yet. She has awareness of it, but it does not cover her bhav or love. At all. My son, the president. But it doesn't, and that's the power of Vrindavan. The Madhurya never gets covered. You cannot criticize that they're not aware, because if they weren't aware, then their love would be ordinary, which does not have the trait of finding enjoyment solely in the enjoyment of the beloved. So it's not clear in this. The Vraja Gopis are exemplified for their devotion. And it says it's not their fault. You can't criticize them that they may be forgetful of Krishna's divinity, because they're not. They have some sense of that. And if they didn't, then their love would be ordinary. And it wouldn't be this transcendental thing of my happiness is the happiness of my beloved. Okay, I think we got a sense of that. Those last verses are a little difficult. So anybody have any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Hey Gail, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. I feel like I understood, you know, the two interpretations that you just spoke. But
which
I'm
made
not
more
clear
sense
about,
to you?
No, they both make sense to me, but I'm not clear about what's not clear.
That they're contradictory. Because one is saying that it's not a fault that they're not aware.
Yeah, because
of their
all they
divinity.
Want is Krishna's happiness.
Yeah, it's not a fault that they're not aware. Right? And the other one said it's not their fault that they're not aware, because they are aware.
Mm-hmm.
And one is saying, right, it's not their fault that they're not aware. You know, because, you know, it would be a big fault if they're not aware, because if they're not aware, it'd just be such ordinary love, you know, and then how would that be the pure love of finding the happiness and the happiness of your beloved? But the other one says, okay, well, yeah, it's not a fault that they're not aware of Krishna's divinity, because they are aware, because mm-hmm. if they weren't aware, then it would just be ordinary love. You got it?
But, but the gopis, you know, one argument was saying that, well, if they're not aware, then it's just ordinary. But here's a case where that's not always the case, because in their case, they might not be aware, and yet their love is pure because all they want, their happiness is exclusively in Krishna's happiness. So
right. That's the one that I like also. That
yeah,
makes
so,
more
I mean,
sense,
what I'm
it?
Saying then is that it's not, you know, it's not how should I say, it's not like 100% true all of the time that if a person is not aware of the nature of the of everything about a person, then it can only be a sentimental thing, you know, because the gopis case defies that. You know, there's the case where their love is real, even though they're not aware fully of the person. So that criterion sounds like it's a little bit faulty, because the gopis, like this, the one that says that you have to be aware of the person's, you know,
yeah, it
nature.
Does seem faulty, doesn't it?
Yeah, because the gopis disprove it.
Right. What it's saying is there's an element of that understanding there. It just doesn't cover it.
No, that's the second one.
And what's
the
first one?
The first one is the first one says that, well, if you don't know the person sufficiently,
yeah,
then if your love can't be pure. But the gopis disprove that. So
okay.
That principle, it sounds faulty to me to say that, well, you have to know the person fully for your love to be pure.
Okay.
Because
okay.
The gopis,
so then the second one was what? What was the second one that you said makes more sense?
No, I'm not saying that. Oh,
well, because I'm actually, I really don't mind discussing it, because I really want to. Here's the first
one. There's two things. One is that for your love to be pure, you
yeah.
have to have, your love has, your happiness has to be exclusively in the happiness of your beloved.
Right.
You know, and.
Right.
And that's, I guess you can say that's the one that I like.
Well,
the
I
other
think
one,
both
say,
let
the
me
other
read,
one says,
let me,
the other
yeah.
one says that if you don't know your beloved fully, then your love is not pure.
Right.
And that's
right.
the one that I think is faulty, because here it is. The gopis, you know, supposedly don't know Krishna fully, yet they do love him purely.
Okay, here's what the BBT translation says, okay? Okay,
mm-hmm.
Even in the case of the gopis, it's first of all, it says, the cowherd women of Vraja are an example of pure bhakti. Even in the case of the gopis, one cannot criticize them for forgetting the Lord's greatness. On the other hand, displays of devotion without knowledge of God's greatness are no better than the affairs of illicit lovers. In such false devotion, one does not find pleasure exclusively in the Lord's pleasure. So does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, when they say forgetting, forgetting implies, you know, they said you can't blame the gopis for forgetting. Forgetting implies that there is knowledge that you're just not always having in the forefront of your consciousness. So, I mean, that's not really, like, contradictory there.
Okay. Okay, we'll take that up some other time, too. Thank you, Gail.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
From me or from others?
From you. I'm being merciful to you today. Causelessly.
I just, you know, it just occurred to me to just say that that it's, you know, kind of, I don't know what to say, interesting and frustrating at the same time to hear you speak my heart so explicitly, you know, when you were discussing the, you know, the, when you were discussing shelter, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I mean, you really, you know, spoke my heart very explicitly, you know, is, you know, I mean, that's exactly my condition, you know, that in terms of what my desire is and what my present condition is, you know? And so
right.
So the frustrating part is, you know, not knowing how to get from here to there.
It's like the fig tree. It's growing, but you don't see it because the fruits come after 2 years.
Mm.
You understand in the story of Ajamil?
Yeah.
When he was chanting and chanting and chanting without a sense. You know, even he was committing still the sinful activities, but at the end, he chanted Nambas, and the analysis is that it was growing, but somehow he wasn't able to access it, and it was invisible. And it was just like, I forgot what tree, a date tree or a fig tree, after 2 years. So after 1 year, you see it's not giving fruits, but it doesn't mean that nothing is happening, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean nothing is happening. And, you know, what you want has to be an exclusive yearning. And perhaps part of that exclusive yearning is this frustration you're feeling. So that itself, the desire to want it, is not a bad sign. It indicates that something is there. Otherwise, why would you feel so distressed that you're not having it?
Anyway, thank you for your causeless mercy.
My what?
So thank you for your causeless mercy and allowing me to express that.
Thank you, Gail. Mm-hmm. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Bajrani Nirmal.
Bajrani, hey, Hari Bo. Wow. Okay. I should be down now, yeah?
Oh.
I'll be down your way.
When Maharaj?
What? Before I go
when
to
are
India.
You going to come this?
What's that? Well, around my Vyas Puja. I'm very busy. What I'm doing now is I'm up here and I'm actually writing a commentary on the Narada Bhakti Sutras. Then after that, maybe I'll take a day or an evening off next Tuesday and go to the Yoga Maya to Satchinandana Swami's Kirtan, but I won't stay up there. I'll go back. Then I come back, and I have a 3-day seminar in Yoga Maya, 12 hours, which is on bhakti. And then I have, then I go to my friends Henry in Washington. I haven't been with him this year. Then I go to Delaware, contemplating maybe just stopping briefly at the Philadelphia Rathi Atra on my way from Delaware. That's my Vyas Puja. And then after my Vyas Puja, I'm a day in New Jersey, then go to New York, and then I'm out. Anyway, that's my schedule. Okay. But next year you have
Should
to come up here with your family. What?
Should I send some more rotis?
No, I have enough. I'm okay with that now. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Kumar.
I really appreciate Kumar coming there. Dallas, I'm even thinking because there's another person in Dallas that asked me to come. David Prosta. Maybe next year I'll come there for a day or two. Okay, anybody else like to say hello? Anybody else? Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna, Panchakalpa, Tubhya, Jaya Krishna.